Session number 14978, Charles Turnbull, Reel 7.
Turnbull, Reel 7. We were talking, Mr. Turnbull, about the initial attacks that were being made upon your brigade around the Arras area. Seeing the survivors of the other two battalions coming through, what effect had that upon you? They must have been in a pretty bad state.
Well, it made us wonder, really. Now we had a taste of exactly what it meant. We're a little bit, apprehensive and abhorred the idea that such things could happen. Really, we hadn't had great training, and initially we were, should I say, a little nonplussed about it all.
Did this make you angry towards the hierarchy who had put you into this situation?
I think initially that it did. To think that really the forces should be placed in this position, and it made one feel as though really preparation for war should be a thing that should be thought about very, very closely at all times, that really we got over the First World War and really had the effect of that really sunk in, that really it made one think that the authorities must have thought that really such acts wouldn't happen again in the future. And precautions, in my opinion, hadn't been taken the way that they should have been. That the questions of weapons that should be available and tactics and all this sort of thing, that hadn't been explored in the right manner. If this offensive by the German army had been so successful, what had been the thinking at the War Office, that really had they been completely out of touch with what warfare could be like in the future, really had too much emphasis been placed on this idea of fortifications like the French, that really had made one think, well, really, the Germans had gone into the thing more thoroughly, and the brains of the whoever had been in touch, in control of the German forces, must have been thinking in a better direction than what we had been thinking about. And it did really, at the time, I would say, make one feel quite angry that we had been placed in such a position.
Your battalion pulled back into Arras, you said. Mm. What happened next?
Well, the next thing was that things were really completely disorganised. And what I can remember is next, that really with limited transport, again, which had been supplied by the RESC on a limited nature, we were transported both by ferrying and marching. One place that comes into your mind was that we went into Lens, where we went through in the dusk of the evening, and there was a skirmish there with it was occupied by German snipers, but we got through all right. And we went up into a place called Gondicourt, and Colonel Marley, who was still the battalion commander, he rallied what forces he could, the remnants of from the 11th and the 12th, and any stragglers that littered in, and he formed a force which was later known as Marley Force, which really, I think, took the form of the 70th Brigade. And when we were in Gondicourt, the thing was that really we were more or less surrounded by German forces. And as a young man, and I can remember sleeping in a barn and wondering really how on earth would we ever get out of Gondicourt. And it was a very disconcerting position. And really, this was achieved after making two attempts, which were a failure, to get out of Gondicourt. And when they were making the attempts, we could hear German tank formations, you know, on the outskirts. But we never came in direct contact with them because the order was given to go back into Gondicourt. Anyhow, on the third occasion, I don't know how he accomplished it, but the we all said Marley, he must have found a way. I don't know whether it was intelligence support forces or whether it was patrol activity or what, but they found a way out through the middle, and eventually were able to escape out of Gondicourt.
Did you get involved in any of the fighting yourself?
Not in Gondicourt. I don't know why, but I must have had, really, whether it was lucky or what, or whether something that had to be. But when any section or a platoon formation or anything was detailed off to guard bridges, or and mostly sections that were given that task, were never seen again. But I seem to achieve that really I was never really detailed off to be in that sort of a situation. That really all I can remember was that when the order came to sort of make our way back, and well, it was retreat really. It was how to keep marching and keep going and survive. We were again bombed and strafed by German aircraft, and I can remember sheltering in woods and that sort of thing. And of course, by this time, the ration supply and the food situation was more or less non-existent, and we sort of had to live off the land as far as one could. When we found burnt out vehicles and that sort of thing, right, we scrounged around to find out what we could find. I can always remember being in one sheltered wood where we were for 2 or 3 days, and finding a thing that I actually hated when I was in civilian life, was cases of sardines. And Jackie Shreve, I can remember bringing these sardines and saying, right lads, we've got something to eat here. And that's what we had to live on for quite a long period. Another thing was, we found another truck where they had sticks of macaroni and prunes. And I can always remember the lieutenant dishing out to the platoon formation that he had, right, 4 sticks of macaroni and 3 sticks of prunes, and that's what you've got to get for the day. But anyhow, we managed to survive in those conditions and just make our way back to the best that we could.
Was this leading to looting?
Not looting.
I think the French property, you must have been passing through French villages that were basically empty.
It was more or less finding what we could find in burnt out vehicles, but not looting of houses or anything like that.
How tired were you?
We were tired, but as I said, really, I'd found out that really, in marching situations, I was quite good. That if it came to a long march, I seemed to be able to endure it better than people who had been in the forces quite a long while, the territorial issue, that I found out that even NCOs and that sort of thing, they couldn't seem to stick the long march routine out the same as what the younger element could. Whether it was a case of survival, that one had made up your mind, well, really, if we're given the order to go back, well, we've got to go and keep going and still do the best we could and just obey the orders that came along.
If anyone dropped out, were they left?
There were, really. If you dropped out, well, what could you do about it?
How close had you come to seeing death and seeing people close to you being killed and wounded?
I couldn't say that I actually saw anybody killed very, very closely. But it was more what could say by the wayside. And as I say, really, the 10th Battalion, we were fortunate that where I was, we'd never had a direct conflict. It was more when people were detailed off to guard a road junction or a bridge or a sort of a vulnerable point. If that lieutenant in his section or whatever it was, the people who were detailed off, we never saw them again. They must have just come into contact with opposition and just didn't survive.
Tiredness. You must have been very depressed. How was the morale of the battalion retained under such circumstances?
It was retained to this effect, that the people who were left in this situation, they looked upon Colonel Marley as a great figure. And when one saw him at the head of affairs, it seemed to uplift people. And really, as I said at the outset, a person that I always respected was Captain Stock. And when one seemed to see to this us younger people, when one seemed to see these figures there, one had great respect for them, and one seemed to think that whatever happens, we'll get through somehow.
How important were some of your comrades around you for keeping up morale? I'm thinking in terms of the wit, I think.
Well, that was greatly important, and as I said at the outset, the friends that I made were people that I thought a great deal about, and in particular was this Jack Shreve, who I said had been a great figure playing football for Charlton Athletic. And I did say in my initial remarks to me, he was, well, one of my heroes. And whatever Jack said, he just had that little bit of something where he had the technique to keep one feeling uplifted and keep one's morale going. And also another lad who came in contact was a lad called Ritson, Billy Ritson, who came from Seam, and he was a little older than me. And whilst we were in South Shields, he had come to visit my parents in Hetley Hall. And we used to talk about things that were happening at home and the people that we'd left behind, and that really we must never forget our young days and what we've been taught, and try and keep cheerful and think that in the end we will get back.
Had your religious experiences as a child, did that help you through this?
Yes, I would say that it did, because I can always remember that whilst we were in Gundicourt and in this barn that I was telling you about, I can remember one evening with the lads, and the three lads that I was well associated with, we tried to keep well together and support each other. And I can always remember the religious aspect must have come into it, because I can always remember in the quiet period offering a prayer and praying that somehow we might get out of Gundicourt. That one would say one had never forgot your religious aspect. And I still seem to think about my parents at home, and that really my mother, who I've already mentioned, was quite of a religious nature, and I knew that really her thoughts would be with ours all the time, and wondering how we were getting on and how we would get through all this, because they must be receiving the news of what was happening through the newspapers and the radio, and they must be well up with the situation, and really would be wondering if we would ever be seen again.
You'd have a battalion padre. Did you see much of him?
Yes, we did have a padre, and he did both whilst we were in England and when we came abroad. We did attend church parades, and he had open-air services while we were in France whenever he possibly could. And I would say that the padre was of a great support.
Did you experience any men who are officers who collapsed under the strain, broke down under the strain?
Not in 1940. Later on in the war, we did. But I couldn't say that I saw that happen, really. Probably, if I had to say anything at all, really, that was probably later on when we came to the beaches in Dunkirk, when people were absolutely worn out.
The time scale, do you recall about what time you were in Gundicourt?
I think no more than about 4 days.
And this would be what, late May, mid to late May?
Getting on towards late May by then.
Where did you move to from there, when you did get out?
Well, the order it came that really, that we must try and make our way back to Dunkirk. That the order must have arrived that really the position was more or less hopeless, and it was more or less a containing action as far as possible. That I think it must have been the order must have been given that really the German forces couldn't be contained, and that must be the general feeling all round, that all one could do was try and contain them as far as possible, and get as many people back as possible to the bridgehead as safely as they possibly could.
We're told by your officers what the immediate future
that
held.
That was the plan which was given off that really, whether you got back or not, well, that was a, a difficult situation. But we knew it was going to be a containing action, and it would be a case of fall back. And when your turn came to stopping in the forehead, and the action, the order came to fall back, and that was the object, just to get back to the beachhead.
What do you recall of the rest of that journey back to the beaches?
Just a case of keep going. What was happening all around you was you were mainly attacked all the time by German aircraft. And should I say it was a case of survival?
Any incidents that are standing in your mind?
No vivid memories, really. Nothing that I could really say, apart it was a case of keeping together and supporting each other and doing what you were told.
We still be able to establish a march discipline, which was
similar. Yes, that was maintained, that really it never became a ragged thing. It was sort of coordinated all the time. You're given an order to go back to so-and-so, and it was a case of the transport idea had more or less fizzled out. As I said, initially there was a little bit of ferrying, but even when we got back towards the beachhead, that really no transport was available. It was a case of march.
As you came into the beachhead, what are your memories?
Well, we came into the beachhead. I can remember looking down from the cliffs and seeing the beach has been absolutely congested. And it was obvious that troops on the beach were trying to get away with their small craft. But there again, discipline in the unit, and Marley was still there, was well kept. That really, even on the beaches, you were maintained in order. That really, you weren't allowed to straggle off here and there. And if any strafing came by the German aircraft overhead, when you were still bombed and strafed all the time, that little was seen of British aircraft. All one could do was really, you just sort of made a dash and got into a sand dune or something like that. But there again, as soon as it was over, order was still maintained. And when one still saw Colonel Marley at the head of affairs, you still thought, well, we'll make it somehow. But I can always remember that really one evening the order came that really they were going to try and make another stand on the outskirts of Dunkirk. And really the obvious thing was, you see, that really, well, if this happens, I think in my opinion it could have been a bit of a suicidal operation. Then one would have little chance of getting out of it. And I was one that was detailed off to be part of that formation. We knew that we were going to have to go up there, and I think rejoin units, part of the units that were left of the 6th, 8th and 9th. I think they were still there in the front line, and we were going to have to go up there and reinforce what was left of them. And I think I can remember saying, well, this must be it. If we go up there, we'll not get back. But at the last minute, the order was cancelled for some reason. Why? I don't know. Then what I can remember was by this time, there again, the three lads that I'd become associated with right from the beginning, which I've mentioned the names, we got as far as the pier head on the beach, and the call came for volunteer stretcher bearers, that really there were so many wounded lying around, and there was a hospital ship at the end of the pier head. So we can remember saying to each other, well, we can't do any worse than volunteer for these duties. So as we were carrying stretchers along the pier head of what was left of it, suddenly after one trip a corvette zoomed into the harbour what was left of it, and there was a lieutenant aboard by the gunwale on the side, and he shouted across and he said, right, old lads, you've done plenty, jump aboard. So the three of us jumped aboard, and really that's how we got away from the beach.
Had you been split from your company battalion by
That time? We'd been split.
Had this happened accidentally, or was it just a question that everyone for himself, and you moved near where you're getting?
Well, as I said, the volunteers had come for stretcher bearers, and anybody, regardless of what unit you was in, could volunteer. And we'd become so, I would say, abhorred with the idea that we had no intention of trying to get a small boat from the beach, that we had got to that stage. I would say that the people, if I should say it, it probably by that time become, should I say, suffering from nervous exhaustion, and it become a little bit panic stricken, and we thought that really that wasn't the way, that we had to wait and find out what was organised to get the troops away from the beachhead. We could see ships further out, and we'd made up our minds we would stay there and take what came. Whether we had to stay behind and couldn't get away, well, we'd just have to accept it. And it was just a piece of good fortune, if I could say it, that this had happened. And really, one could say, well, we'd been trailed to obey orders. And when this call came from this lieutenant, we just thought it was automatic, that we had to seize the opportunity and go. Whether we were right or not, well.
Was he a naval
lieutenant? Naval lieutenant.
How long had you been on the beaches?
A few days.
Was there much sign of breaking down and panic when people were seeing, basically, here we are, how are we going to get off? Well, there'd been a lot of men around.
Oh, the beaches were were crammed, really. And I should say that really quite a number of people had sort of given up the ghost. They thought really they wouldn't get away. And one, I don't know whether it was training or what, but you just had to retain a sane attitude about it, and we still felt all right, that really it was a case of, right, if we get away, we get away. If we don't get away, well, what can one do about it? And should I say that one had sort of come to one's mind that really, whatever will be, will be. And if you had the fortune to get away, you'd get away, and if it didn't happen, you'd have to take what came your way, and if it came that you sort of were captured by the juries, well, what could you do about it? That all had been done what could be done, and nothing could be done anymore.
Was there an overall feeling that the beach was still organised and under control and discipline?
I would say that it still was controlled, really. There was an atmosphere that there was people still in command. There wasn't panic. No panic. If we had had to go that night when the order was given, that we'd have to rejoin the troops who had been left behind, well, it was organised and it would have been done. That the officers were in command of the situation.
Did you still have your weapons?
Everybody still, as far as possible, weapons weren't thrown away. Really, the order had been given that any transport that was there had to be dismantled and so that it wouldn't come into German hands, but rifles were still carried by the troops.